and where we are met with cynicism and doubt, and those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can.
Yes, 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 it's time. We all come together. Ha-ha! Barack Obama.
Yes, we can.
Barack Obama. Man, it's coming with a message for the people saying, yes, we can. Sure, si se puede, today is a new day. So come on and throw your hands up, every woman, every man. Barack Obama.
Yes, we can.
Barack Obama.
Change, critical claim, all in it to rebel is the bane of a power to the people, so that we may develop a sequel. For living in love for the peace, for pushing the envelope, honoring all of the work, paying attention to reason, dipping our feet and dipping the moderate work, teaching minds of a new height, seeking fires of a new life. This is the meaning of outreach. When it's out of reach, we still fight.
Barack Obama.
Yes, we can.
Barack Obama.
Everybody, and welcome to Galactic Roundtable with Beth True Twin. We will spend the next little while working together on our ascension. We will work on personal, planetary, galactic, universal, omniversal, and cosmic ascension. The cosmos beyond describes all the non-physical antimatter universes. As we creator gods came to this part of the Nebadon universe, aeons ago, we birthed through Mother Sekhmet's Yani at Galactic Center. The end of time has been prophesied in many ethnic cultures for thousands of years. Last summer, August 17th, 2010, the Milky Way galaxy aligned with the sun. This marked the constellation movements of the Mayan calendar. It came sooner than the predicted December 21st, 2012. Time has speeded up due to the collective consciousness of totality and divine grace of all that is, raising their vibrations in a constant process of ascension to a level where we have surpassed the conjunct of the Milky Way with the sun. We are in the end times. It marks the end of the grand experiment of good and evil, of duality. It marks the end of the fallen angels on Earth planet. With their removal, we will become the 33rd member of the Intergalactic Confederation of Worlds. We all have incarnated in physical bodies on Earth to change from a planet of duality to a planet of peace. We are working with the Syrian commander, Barack Obama, who is the 9th member of the Syrian Council of Nine on Sirius A. His head of Secret Service is a physical template of Lord Sananda, who we call King of Swords. Millions of walk-in souls living in human bodies are all telepathically connected and working together in every walk of life. Police, Interpol, government agencies, military, lawyers, judges, journalists, and too many to list here. Each of us play an important role, where the outcome will be the capture and arrest of the intergalactic war criminals, the fallen angels, who were trying to have Earth and her resources as their own, as well as tens of other planets. We, on the ground crew, work closely with the Galactic Federation, headed by the Admiral Lord Sananda, a higher aspect of the Prophet Jesus, also known as Yeshua, and the Captain, Lord Ashtar. They have full say in many of the aspects of this mission for Earth ascension. They work directly with President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama, as well as millions of other white knights around the world. They ask that we call on them as we need to for more help in our lives to help us with our mission. Feel free to call on them and they will be there at your service. You play an important part in this as you wake up to truth and share the news with others. We must work together to dissolve the programming within the Matrix. I will be pre-recording this program every week. I will be doing it recorded, not live, because it is better for my life situation. It is also less expensive to do a program without the use of an engineer answering the calls and monitoring. I want to thank BBS Radio, the greatest internet radio in the galaxy, for inviting me to be here each week. This is our family and where we join to check in with each other at galacticroundtable.com. I keep this site up to date every day as part of my spiritual service. I have 2 volunteers working with me, and they lovingly devote their service every day. I'm grateful for all who are part of the family at Galactic Roundtable. I manage to keep everything going with your donations, and you may find a donation button on the site. I use the money for electric, Wi-Fi, server fees, and radio broadcasting. I thank you, everybody, for your continuous generosity and love. In exchange, I work hard to give back as much as possible, and you may look at my other website, www.cosmicascension.com. I'm continuously adding to it, and there are many features for self-discovery and healing. This is a place where we go and we raise the questions, where am I? Who am I? Where am I from? And why am I here? I am beginning my charitable mission for World Service post-Nasara. You can find information about Antares Arcturus Midway Foundation at aamidway.com. And as we carry out lives of service to our fellow women, child, and men on Earth inside the Matrix, we continue to have tests and challenges from that concept that I affectionately call 3D. The first dimension is a point in space. The second dimension is a plane, a flat, barren surface. The third dimension is latitude. Imagine a cube with six planes connected together, the top, bottom, and four sides, floating up and down. Within this cube is the third dimensional space. The fourth dimension is time, pure and simple, a point in space in relation to time on a timeline and a dimension. The fifth dimension is the etheric realm with no time. We exist there simultaneously now. We travel in our etheric bodies to the etheric realms at night when we sleep. Our etheric bodies are known by many names, such as our avatar body, like Jake Sully and Neytiri, the lion woman, in the movie Avatar. They are also known as our cosmic consciousness. We are multidimensional beings living on multidimensional Earth as one people, one land, one love. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable on BBSRadio.com, Station 2, where we will discuss all things galactic with divine grace in the totality of all that is. Welcome. Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable. This is Beth. Tonight will be a special presentation on Lord Ashtar and the Galactic Federation. I'd like to introduce you to some of the gems that Ashtar left us, and I want to share those with you tonight. The first thing I want to do is start off tonight with a prayer and then a meditation. So I'm going to play some music, and this song that I'll be playing is not in English, but I'll tell you that the words say that it's an invocation to the flame that's in the center of your heart, your violet flame, the flame that ignites all wisdom and all love inside of you. This song is worshiping the flame that's inside your own heart and saying that when you pay homage to that flame, then you become one with your highest self and all your dreams come true. This full moon that we had back in July is the once a year full moon to the guru. So it's to our teachers, and tonight Ashtar is our teacher. So the full moon in July and August is called the Guru Purima, and it is a time to rededicate ourselves to our mentors, to learning sacred scripture, and becoming one with wisdom and enlightenment. So please relax, enjoy the song, and we'll go right into meditation following that. Thank you.
जय जय श्री सुदर्शन शुभ जगद्रूप मंडन सुरजन त्रास खंडन शतमख ब्रह्म वंदिता शतपथ प्र ब्रह्मानंदिता प्रथित विद्वत्सपक्षिता अजनहिर्बुद्ध्यलक्षिता जय जय श्री सुदर्शन जय जय श्री सुदर्शन निज पद प्रीत सद्गण निरुपधिस्फीत षड्गुण निगम निर्व्यूढ वैभव निज परम व्यूह वैभव हरिहय द्वेषिदारण हरपुर प्लोषकारण जय जय श्री सुदर्शन जय जय श्री सुदर्शन स्फुटतटिज्जाल पिञ्जर रुधुतरज्ज्वाल पञ्जर परिगत प्रत्न विग्रह परिमित प्रज्ञ दुर्ग्रह प्रहरण ग्राम मंडित परिजन त्राण पंडित जय जय श्री सुदर्शन जय जय श्री सुदर्शन भुवन नेतस्त्रयी मया सवन तेजस्त्रयी मया निरवधि स्वादु चिन्मया निखिल शक्ते जगन्मया अमित विश्वक्रियामया शमित विश्वद्भयामया जय जय श्री सुदर्शन जय जय श्री सुदर्शन महित संपत् सदक्षर विहित संपत् षडक्षर षडर चक्र प्रतिष्ठित सकल तत्व प्रतिष्ठित विविध संकल्प कल्पक विमुध संकल्प कल्पक जय जय श्री सुदर्शन जय जय श्री सुदर्शन प्रतिमुखालीढ बंधुरा पृथु महाहेति दंतुरा विकट माला परिष्कृत विविध माया बहिष्कृत स्थिर महायंत्र यंत्रिता दृढ़दया तंत्र यंत्रिता जय जय श्री सुदर्शन जय जय श्री सुदर्शन धनुज विस्तार कर्तन धनुज विद्या विकर्तन जनित मिश्रा विकर्तन भजद विद्या निकर्तन अमर दृष्ट स्विक्रम समर जुष्ट भ्रमिक्रम जय जय श्री सुदर्शन जय जय श्री सुदर्शन द्विजदुष्कमिदं प्रभूतसारं पठतां वेङ्कटनायक प्रणीतं विषमे मनोरथ प्रधावन् न विहन्येत रथाङ्गदुर्यगुप्तः इति श्रीवेदान्ताचार्यस्य कृतिषु सुदर्शनाष्टकम्।
Okay, I hope you're completely relaxed now. I'm going to start some background sounds for our meditation. And it's loading. Okay. Here's our meditation. Make yourself comfortable on the floor or in a chair, keeping spine and neck in alignment. Arms relaxed by your side or in your lap, Then close your eyes gently. Now focus on your breathing. Remember that the breath and the mind are closely connected. By controlling the breath and making it very slow, you are calming the mind. This calm is essential to good health. Now relax each limb of your body. Start by giving the toes a gentle shake. Then relax them. Relax the ankles and the lower legs, the knees, the thighs, the hips. Wherever there is a joint, concentrate on relaxing there. The upper and lower limbs will automatically relax. In the same manner, release all tension and tightness in your spine and back. Relax your navel area and feel the entire abdomen relax. Relax your chest so heart and lungs will benefit. Then the shoulders, relaxing the arms. Continue with the forehead to relax face and scalp. The entire body is now completely relaxed. Breathe slowly and evenly and quiet the mind. Know that all is well. You are safe and secure. All your needs are taken care of. Now visualize yourself lying on the beach. Make it the most beautiful beach you have ever seen. Notice the color of the sand and the clarity of the water. Slowly walk down to the water. Go in to where you feel comfortable. Then lie down and float on the water. Allow the water to support you entirely. Allow the motion of the water to lull you and comfort you. Relax completely into the water, knowing at all times that you are completely safe. Now allow yourself to go under the water. Imagine yourself swimming effortlessly, as though the water were your home. You can breathe easily, as though you were on dry land. Swim around and explore all the pretty rocks and plants you see. Look at the many fish swimming past you. You are at home here. You feel safe and secure. Now float to the top and let yourself rest on the surface again. Feel the rhythmic movement of the waves carry you and become one with your breathing. Let your awareness expand and blend with the waves until you become one with the waves. Observe the spray that flies into the air, then mistily filters down again to join the wave. Watch how free it is and how easily it gives of itself, knowing that no harm will come to it, knowing that it will return and once more become the wave. Visualize yourself being as free and unconcerned as the ocean spray. Trust the universe to take total care of you. The sun is overhead, shining warmly. All about you are the reflections of the sunlight on the water, like tiny suns, unique lights unto themselves that dance and move with the motion of the water. Allow your body to disperse itself further over the ocean surface. Stretch out and let the lights that are dancing over the surface dance over you as your body and the ocean surface blend and merge. Feel that you have become millions of tiny sparkling lights. slowly, gently, begin to pull your body back together, leaving behind any distress, soreness, or disease. Very gently, your body takes form again, floating once more on the surface of the ocean. Now you may glide gently back to the beach again. Feel the sand beneath you and let it run through your fingers. Stretch out in the sunlight and absorb the light of life, of the life-giving sun. Then slowly let the scene fade from your mind. Become aware of your breathing and of your body in this room. Slowly begin to move hands and feet. Stretch your arms above your head and give your whole body a good stretch. Relax, and when you are ready, open your eyes and observe how you feel. All right, wonderful. Now I want to share with you, everybody, what I learned about Ashtar when I started researching who is Ashtar. Lord Ashtar is an Alohi angel, originally from the planet Ashtar. He has had extensive experiences at Venus, Pleiades, and Nibiru as well. Lord Ashtar with Admiral Sananda Jesus are in charge of the universe Nebadon. Our universe is one in a seven-universe system. Admiral Lincor is the head of the Starfleet through the Intergalactic Confederation of Seven Super-Universes. Lord Ashtar is the captain on the flagship, the New Jerusalem, which is one of in the fleet of ships in the Galactic Federation. The Admiral, Sananda Jesus, was incarnate on Earth as Jesus the Christ. Lord Sananda has had seven Earth incarnations and has also been known as Zoroaster, Tutankhamun, and Jesus. Lord Ashtar has had one Earth incarnation as Pakovotan. He is revered as the chief engineer who guided the Mayan mission of inscripting stone monuments with precise astronomical and astrological information during his reign in the 10th Bakhtun in Palenque. Ashtar and the Mayans. Lord Ashtar incarnated once on Earth, though he has incarnated on other planets. He was the avatar, Pakovotan, of the Mayan culture. The ancient Mayan priests claimed that the spirit of Pakovotan came from the stars, and that was why he brought the wisdom of the stars with him. They also said that after arriving in our mother Earth, he decided to work with the human beings, forever teaching them all the current well-known sciences, plus other unknown sciences that are even unknown to us these days. Pakovotan used to say that every initiate should be aware of knowing the 13 dimensions of the physical realm, because the explanations to all the existing mysteries in the world, either physically or non-physically, could be found there. In the Mayan lands, Pakovotan used to teach the secret of the Kundalini, better known today as the Kundalini. In this way, the priestly class knew and practiced the seven powers in such the same way that they were known in India. Pakovotan also taught his Mayan people the handling of the seven powers held in the human body. And using the Mayan word chakla, he used to point out parts of the initiates' bodies where that great power coming from the cosmic power would flow out. In India, they use a similar word, chakra. The avatar Pocahontas was a great astrologer and astronomer. To the Mayan people of the Yucatan Peninsula and ancient America, he resided in the holy city of Palenque, which was built in the center of a triangular grid between the three points of Chichen Itza, Tres Zapotes, and Caminluya. Palenque and Pacovotan's Temple of the Inscriptions is often compared to the Egyptian Pyramid of Giza for several intriguing reasons. One is that both ancient sites are situated in the center of the geological landmass of their respective hemisphere, resulting in a perfect balance of male and female energy. Pacovotan had a mission of bringing culture and teaching practices for enlightenment. He was a time-traveling shapeshifter who was adept in healing and taught the quantum physics of traveling through wormholes as string theorists teach today. Ashtar in ancient India as one of the Hindu gods. Hindu religious literature is known as the Vedas. The Vedas are a large body of literature, including the two Indian epics, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, as well as the Puranas. Lord Ashtar came to Earth during the ancient Hindu period and taught the sage Vasishta the galactic wisdom teachings. This is known as the Ashtar Vidya or Ashtar knowledge. This oral tradition was taught to the rishis more than 2 million years ago and eventually was transcribed to become the Agni Purana. This was the Starfleet Academy teachings from Ashtar. Besides, theology and voluminous epics also provide information about Indian society, philosophy, culture, religions, and ways to live life. The Vedas teach one how to enter the path to enlightenment. The 18 Puranas deal with stories that are old and do not appear in the epics. Purana is Sanskrit for ancient. The derivative noun Purana means ancient history. The epics themselves are set in different epics or aeons of time. The Ramayana, written by the poet Valmiki, describes the life and times of Lord Rama, the seventh avatar of Lord Vishnu, and occurs in the Tetrayuga, while the Mahabharata, that describes the life and times of Rama Arjuna and Lord Krishna, the eighth avatar of Lord Vishnu, occurs in the Dwapara Yuga. The Agni Purana has a number of verses dealing with ritual worship, cosmology and astrology, history, warfare, sections on grammar and meter, law, medicine, martial arts, mudras, iconography, symbols, and that of a description of the universe. Ashtar came then to guide the culture of India to a higher teaching and toward enlightened living, culturing world peace. In the Agni Purana, it describes Buddha and Kalki as avatars of Lord Vishnu. Agni is considered a messenger from and to the other gods. He is ever young because the fire is relit every day and he is also immortal. With Varuna and Indra, he is one of the supreme gods in the Rig Veda. The light Agni emits is the light of knowledge. Therefore, it is also known as the illuminator of knowledge who lights up the path leading to truth. Agni reveals the true nature of one's own self because it is the innermost light that shines ever so brightly in all things living and non-living as their inner conscious or Atman. Agni is the eldest son of Brahma. In Vishnu Purana, Agni, also known as Abhimani, the fire god, is said to have sprung from the mouth of the cosmic man. As the eldest son of Brahma, Abhimani represents the cosmic logos, the first force produced in the universe at its evolution, the fire of cosmic creative desire. The fire god Agni is fabled to melt his enemies with fire springing from his hand. We see this in Ashtar today, who emits the violet flame, which is a force of love, from the center of the palms of his hands, to fight the dark ones who forgot how to love. Preparing for the new golden age on Earth. Ashtar brought a series of messages through an American in 1955 in the form of automatic writings. Automatic writing, or psychography, is writing which the writer states to be produced from a spiritual source without conscious awareness. The writer of a 15-chapter book wrote messages from Ashtar with instructions and suggestions on preparing for the golden age of peace on Earth. In this book, Ashtar describes how he and the Galactic Federation members plan on returning to the Earth in the days to come to renew and rejuvenate a new Earth. He goes into great details about steps we can take to prepare for this change. He repeatedly says in this work that the Galactic Federation has come back to fulfill a promise made by his commanding officer, Sananda Jesus, to return to Earth and restore heaven on Earth. He tells us this means he and many others will be landing their ships on Earth and coming to live with us in our societies. He lets us know that pursuing peace and an end of nuclear destruction will aid in bringing this time of reunion closer. Ashtar's role today. Lord Ashtar and Lord Sananda Jesus are the sole deciders in Earth ascension and when it is appropriate to decloak the starships in the fleets in Earth's orbit. When this happens, Ashtar is in charge of creating a force field on Earth through the Earth grid, connected through the pyramids, ziggurats, and portals of Earth, which will bring us to zero point. Within this energy, much more advanced technology is possible. To illustrate the Earth grid, we have an example of Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon is where the transfiguration of Jesus took place. Mount Hermon is located in the Golan Heights area and was gained by Israel in the land grab of the Six Days War in 1967. Mount Hermon is a stargate. Jesus took his disciples, Peter, James, and John, with him to the mountaintop. The three then fell asleep. A starship appears, and Jesus meets with his galactic travelers, Elijah and Moses. They come out of the ship onto the mountain, and Jesus appears in his glowy or etheric body to his disciples. Mount Hermon is located on the 33rd latitude line of Earth. If you follow the 33rd parallel around to the other side of Earth, you also find on the 33rd parallel Roswell, New Mexico, United States. This is the site of the famous UFO crash which resulted in the recovery of live extraterrestrials. The Earth grid is an electromagnetic and crystalline pathway for etheric ships. Lord Ashtar's mission is to help us wake up to the potential of New Earth by guiding us to ending all nuclear arms and preparing for world peace. The Galactics refuse to share any new technology with us until we are living in peace. If any new technology were introduced today, it would be stolen by the fallen angels and used for new weaponry. Ashtar and the Galactic Federation return now to return heaven on Earth, as has been promised by the King of Kings. Those are the things that I share in the book. I share advanced knowledge and wisdom concerning these books that he's written and what it means to us now. And it's absolutely fascinating. I know you will love it. So right now what I want to do is I want to take a break and I want to listen to a presentation about how there is life on the moon even today with all the proofs that are with it. There is new research come out that is absolutely fascinating. It's just come out in the last few days. So we'll take a break from this and listen to that for a little while. And afterwards, I want to share with you from each of Ashtar's books. So stay tuned. All right, everybody. So what I want to do now is I want to give you a presentation that is fascinating about the UFOs on the moon. And afterwards, I'm going to read to you from Ashtar's three books. And you will find knowledge there that you never knew existed from Ashtar. And that'll be a lot of fun. So let's take a break from reading right now and enjoy this. This is UFO Moon Rising by Jose Escamilla. And it is on YouTube for your enjoyment. And Jose is a researcher for Roswell Crash and UFOs for a very long time. I hope you enjoy it.
Who presents the news from Washington? Here is Bob Pierpoint. Another larger Sputnik with a dog named Curly aboard is now whirling around the Earth 1,000 miles out in space. The Russians launched an 1,100-pound satellite late last night, and so far both Sputnik 2 and its canine passenger are reported doing well.
The dramatic achievements in space which occurred in recent weeks should have made clear to us all, as did the Sputnik in 1957, impact of this adventure on the minds of men everywhere who are attempting to make a determination of which road they should take.
Radio Moscow started broadcasting time schedules for its latest satellite a short while ago with the announcement that Sputnik 2 will pass over Washington, D.C. in just a few minutes from now. Dr. J. Allen Hynek, well-known associate director of the Smithsonian Observatory at Cambridge, Massachusetts, was asked if the half-ton weight of Sputnik 2 indicated the Russians might have a war rocket powerful enough to reach this continent from the Soviet Union. It certainly indicates they have the capabilities of launching an intercontinental ballistic missile, replied Dr. Hynek.
Now it is time to take longer strides. Time for a great new American enterprise. Time for this nation to take a clearly leading role in space achievement, which in many ways may hold the key to our future on Earth.
Dr. John S. Reinhardt, also with the Smithsonian Observatory, commented after studying figures on the new Soviet satellite, I firmly believe the Russians could reach the moon in a few days.
I believe we should go to the moon. But I think every citizen of this country, as well as the members of the Congress, should consider the matter carefully. Every scientist, every engineer, every serviceman, every technician, contractor and civil servant gives his personal pledge that this nation will move forward with the full speed of freedom in the exciting adventure of space. We go into space because whatever mankind must undertake, free men must fully share.
On January 25, 1994, the Deep Space Program science experiment known as Clementine was launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base. Clementine was able to deliver more than 1.8 million digital images between February 26th and April 22nd, 1994. These images were quickly accessible to the general public on the World Wide Web. In 1994, President Clinton cited the Clementine mission as one of the major national achievements in aeronautics in space.
By going to the Clementine Lunar Image Browser 1.5, you can find many images that have been smudged or blurred to keep you from seeing what is there. Click on the desired resolution section and choose 1 pixel equals 1 kilometer option. Then by going to the image size in pixels option, choose 768 by 768. You are now ready to see for yourself a huge object on the surface of the moon. On the moon map, you will easily see a dot on the top of this crater and on the lower left. Click on the black dot on top of the crater and a close-up image of this section appears in the browser. What you see is a huge object resting at the top of this crater. It appears to be a large machine or perhaps a large spaceship or a motor of some kind. You can clearly see this photograph has been smudged over and blurred so we cannot see the details. This little gem was discovered and brought to the attention of moon researchers all over the world by Joseph P. Skipper on May 28, 2004. I decided to hire an imaging forensics expert to take this photo and to try and remove the blurring to reveal what is underneath. Jim Horrocks, an imaging forensics expert who has worked with the Los Angeles Police Department, was sent this photo, and his findings were written in a report he submitted to the production. First of all, the astounding measurements he made reveal an object that is 10 times the size of Los Angeles. 10 times the size. This in itself is an incredible detail about the size of this object. By using Adobe Photoshop and some of the filters available within the program, we were able to see more of the details that were lost due to the blurring applied by whoever did this for NASA and the Clementine Mission Archives. This enormous object seems to be some form of a machine or possibly a spacecraft. In all the enhancements made independently, it appears there may have been what appears to be a giant humanoid wearing a jumpsuit and possibly working on the front portion of this contraption. This may or may not be a giant humanoid. Perhaps the shadows seem to reflect something of a human form. We will never know until NASA releases this photograph, unblurred and with the clarity available for us to see. By clicking on the new lunar map now available, you will now see that the same crater is available for viewing in all its clarity. There is no object there anymore, and there is no smudging of anything near or within the crater. We have to ask ourselves, if there is nothing on the moon that suggests alien moon bases, strange structures, machines, and possible civilizations thriving there, then why has there been a deliberate tampering of these and thousands of images we will present here in this film? One of the many challenges I had to deal with in making this film was how the structures on the moon were to be presented. Unfortunately, most of all the Apollo and orbiter photos are black and white. Many photos are in low resolution, so zooming into them for a closer look causes the photos to blur and become pixelated, making it impossible to see details of what's on the surface. While I was designing a poster for the film in Photoshop, I decided that I did not want a black and white photo in the background of the poster. So I decided to color the background image I was using so I would have a full-color poster for the film. I took some full-color aerial photos of landscapes that closely resemble the distances of the moon's surface, turned them into black and white photos, and compared them to the moon photo I was about to airbrush. Noticing the different shades of the aerials from Earth and the colors represented, I then started making a color palette in Photoshop. All I did was airbrush the colors onto the moon photo as they appeared on Earth. But the structures and other objects on the moon revealed themselves. I was so overwhelmed at the results, I have now colorized over 247 photos. Now that I had come up with a format and a routine for colorizing the moon, I decided to gather the most famous Apollo moon anomaly photos that researchers from all over the world had been presenting for years and decided to colorize them. This is one of the many original NASA photos that has some very unique anomalies, especially here in this area. This is what it looks like after we bring up the contrast to eliminate the brightness applied to distort the image. And this is what it looks like after applying my colorizing process to it. So remember, these are colors and tones I use from Earth photography applied to the moon's surface. With Earth colors applied, you can see all the details with depth perception as never before.
By painting the moon with earth colors and tones, we can now see what has been there all along for us to view.
I got started in this probably in the mid-1990s, listening to Hoagland on the old Coast to Coast AM radio program with Art Bell. And he was talking about the stuff that he'd found on the moon, and some images and some things that clearly appeared to be structures that were very anomalous. And he was noting that there were thousands upon thousands of photographs that had been taken of the moon by the various unmanned probes and the astronauts that had orbited the moon. And he said, you know, Art, anybody can do this. And what I realized is, A, I'm anybody. B, I think I understand the arguments. I'm an engineer by trade, so aerospace engineer, so I may not be an architect, but I certainly know structure when I see it. And I started looking at the evidence that he presented, and I just got fascinated by it. I created a web page called the Lunar Anomalies homepage, which still exists, and it was all dedicated to stuff on the moon.
The Hubble telescope has taken the most incredible photography of deep space and far off in the vast universe. When you see these spectacular scenes, you can't help but wonder how many others live out there. So when NASA was asked by scientists and astronomers when the Hubble telescope would be used in photographing the moon, NASA's reply was that because the moon was too bright, it would be impossible to get accurate photography of the moon. The first photo was released from the Hubble Space Telescope in 1999. Needless to say, the scientists and astronomers were not too pleased at how NASA had deliberately lied to them. When I heard about this photograph, I thought for sure we would see the moon in full color. But of all the photos taken by the Hubble telescope of the moon, they are in black and white. After colorizing all these photos, you can't help but learn the moon's layout. After all, it is a small planet compared to Earth.
Prepare yourself for an incredible expedition as we now take you back to the moon on a voyage filled with mystery and secrecy.
I'm not sure why NASA has not told us what's on the moon. In a way, they have told us because the pictures are there, and there's hundreds of them. So anybody can do what I did. I'm going to look at the pictures and enlarge them and see what there is.
NASA has been there, but we haven't been back since 1972. And you kind of sit there and wonder why that is. It's our closest celestial neighbor in the heavens. You can see it every night when you walk outside, and really there's so much mystery about it still to this day. Many people seem to think that the Apollo program answered a lot of these questions, and in many ways it did, but we, the general public, have never been privy to any of those answers.
Is there already somebody there? And is there even a secret space program that we don't know about, that maybe even NASA doesn't know about, that's been to the moon and back and using very advanced technology?
A cover story that's based entirely upon the premise that there is absolutely no life there, and that there's no life to be found, past, present, at all. That's simply not the case.
So I certainly believe that some of the stuff that we're finding on the moon may be alien, extraterrestrial in origin. It may be ruined, ancient, abandoned extraterrestrial ruins. Some of it may be active, and some of it, in fact, may be our own stuff.
I don't think there's any possibility that NASA is not aware of the civilizations on the moon and the structures. They're very obvious, easy to see.
They are in contact with some of these extraterrestrial life forms, and they don't want you to know about it.
There was the guy that hacked into the NASA database and found some listings of non-terrestrial officers.
NASA may have made a deal with beings up there to not reveal their civilization. But then again, the pictures have the evidence. It's all in pictures anyway.
The whole purpose to the cover-up is to prevent we, the plebeian masses of this planet, from gaining the appreciation that there is indeed extraterrestrial life out there, intelligent extraterrestrial life. And this is life that the government is very well aware of. The governments around the world, it's certainly not a U.S. issue. They're very well aware of it.
Because you've been lied to, you've been robbed of something that you deserve, which is to know what your true history is and what your true significance is in this world.
I really don't think people realize how deep the lie goes, how big it is, how unbelievable the cover-up is. This truly is the greatest story ever denied. Secret never told. It is the most monumental cover-up in human history. And hopefully the public will take a movie like this and will begin to open up some doors, begin to open up some windows to the truth, whether it's from the government, whether it's from other insiders who can now come forward and begin to tell their stories of what they did and their involvement in this cover-up to get the truth out there. I think the world's ready for it. And hopefully a movie like this will push that forward a little bit and speed the process up.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know.
By playing around with these images, using modern software techniques, some of the results really are eye-opening. And again, it really comes back to, you've got to ask yourself the question, why do NASA or any of the other space agencies or any of the major observatories, why will they not show you any of the new adaptive optics imagery of the moon? They simply won't show it to you. They don't have any, they claim.
A report was prepared under contract to NASA by the Brookings Institute, Washington, D.C. The report outlines the need to investigate the possible social consequences of an extraterrestrial discovery and to consider whether such a discovery should be kept from the public in order to avoid political change and a possible devastating effect on scientists themselves due to the discovery that many of their own most cherished theories could be at risk.
And it says in there that you should seriously consider covering that information up, because it may in fact lead to what it calls the disintegration of our culture because of the tremendous cultural impact, the shock that it would have, especially to scientists and engineers who think, who've come to believe arrogantly, I think, that we are the top of the heap, that we are some part of some natural process and we are the dominant species. I don't think that that argument flies. I think that document is nothing more than their political and legal cover for what they've been doing. Because there is a much bigger issue that comes out here. What most people don't know is that, you know, NASA is not a civilian science agency. If you look at the actual charter under which NASA was originally put into existence, it states clearly there that NASA is an adjunct, a division of the Department of Defense, and it is beholden to the Department of Defense.
When you couple the Brookings Institute report with a document called Executive Order 10501. 10501 was a document that was specifically related to safeguarding official information in the interests of national defense. And it's important to note that the term national defense actually includes not only considerations of a military perspective, but also geoeconomic and geopolitical as well. And when you compare or take those two documents, when you take 10501 and the Brookings Institute report, right there, that lays the framework for the greatest story ever denied. That gives them legal justification to cover this up.
Speculated the moon missions were hoaxed. Perhaps some of the Apollo missions were filmed in different locations and in studios in order to conceal the incredible discoveries found on the moon. In 1979, Marie Chatelain, former chief of NASA Communications Systems, confirmed Neil Armstrong had indeed reported seeing two UFOs on the rim of a crater. The encounter was common knowledge at NASA, he revealed, but nobody has talked about it until now.
Even if you don't care what's up there, you damn sure care about the lies that are being put in place to hide what's up there. You know, whether you have the interest in the space program or the interest in what's going on over our planet's atmosphere or not, you are affected by the lies that are in place to maintain this greatest of all cover-ups. And we're talking about just a massive effort by the military-industrial complex.
Couple of nuclear weapons sent into space were destroyed by the extraterrestrials. Our government sent a nuclear weapon for explosion on the moon's surface. It was tended to, as I understand it, to assess some scientific data and reaction and so forth.
When I was a corporate manager of Fairchild Industries in 1974 through 77, I met the late Dr. Werner von Braun in early 74. At that time, von Braun was dying of cancer, but he assured me that he would live a few more years in order to tell me about the game that was being played, that game being the effort to weaponize space.
The idea of any explosion in space by any Earth government was not acceptable to the extraterrestrials, and that has been demonstrated over and over.
The strategy that Werner von Braun taught me was that first the Russians are going to be considered to be the enemy. In fact, when I met him in 74, they were the enemy.
They wanted a weapon system they could put in space that would stop a ballistic missile. That was the concept.
Then terrorists would be identified, and that was soon to follow. We heard a lot about terrorism.
Now, if that ballistic missile happened to be coming from another direction other than earthbound, could it do the same thing?
Then we were going to identify third world country crazies. We now call them nations of concern.
I have but a short time to try to convince people that we are moving in an avenue where we are going to militarize space.
The next enemy was asteroids. And the funniest one of all was against what he called aliens, extraterrestrials. That would be the final card.
As a direct result, we will become a threat to them unless we spiritually grow also.
And over and over and over, during the 4 years that I knew him, he would bring up that last card. And remember, Carol, the last card is the alien card. We're going to have to build space-based weapons against aliens. And all of it, he said, is a lie.
We put nuclear weapons out in space as a line of defense, and we was ready to blow them up if they started in.
Today, most people have come to the very clear realization, I think, that things aren't quite as you've been told, and the question then just becomes is, how big is the lie? And the truth is, it's bigger than most people can imagine. One of the great things about the NASA archive system is that at the back of many of their documents, they have both distribution and reference lists, and the distribution lists are very important. They say who that document is being forwarded to and which department and for what company. And when you begin to cull through these documents, certainly ones that deal with specific subject matter, like image enhancement, for example, you begin to see a lot of names that obviously begin to repeat. And you can very quickly determine what individuals knew what and had to have been privy to certain information just by the very nature of their job. The individual that I managed to identify and who agreed to meet with me and talk with me was a man who worked for a company called Bellcom during the 1960s and into the early 1970s. Bellcom, although many people haven't heard of it, is in many ways a company that is more responsible for landing man on the moon than NASA really was. Bellcom's a division of AT&T and Western Electric. Bellcom was around for only a decade. They were there for the specific purpose of landing man on the moon and ensuring that NASA got the job done. Meeting him was actually the most incredible 3 hours of my life, the interview that we had. A man who I knew was in the know, a man who I'd tracked down. He wasn't in any way looking to throw this stuff out in the public eye. It was just really a matter of him recognizing that I wasn't on a total blind fishing expedition, and I'd actually figured some things out. That opened him up in a big way. He'd made the comment several times during the interview that he'd never talked about this with anyone before. It was not the kind of subject matter that you talk with anyone about. The people that were in a position to be in the know, to have at least some high level of understanding of what was really going on, these individuals are also very well aware of what their government is actually capable of.
A guard told me that he was asked to burn some photographs and not to look at them. And there was a guard, another guard guarding him, who was in green fatigues, watching him burn the photographs. And he said he was too tempted. He looked at one, and it was a picture of a UFO. And he was very descriptive. I can go into that later with anyone. He immediately was hit in the head, and he had a big gash in his forehead. He was knocked out, and he's terrified. So he would have to be protected. Another incident, I knew someone in quarantine with the Apollo astronauts. He told me that the Apollo astronauts saw crap on the moon when we landed. And that is what he told me. And he also was afraid. He said that the astronauts are told to keep this quiet. They're not allowed to talk about it. So I do want to let you know that I worked out there for a number of years, and this I ran into this. So it's not something everyone knows that works out there for a long time. My boss didn't know about it. Some people that sat right next to me didn't know about it. It's very strange because I don't know how they can do it, but they can let some people know about it and then others not. I'm willing to testify before Congress that what I'm saying is true, and thank you very much.
They know the power of these people. A lot of people ask questions like, well, how come none of these people who knew about it have ever come forward? These individuals assign their lives away in security classification documents. And when I say sign their lives away, I mean that quite literally. I mean, these are things that if they talk about, it's off to Guantanamo Bay. This is the greatest secret in not only the United States military and the United States government, but around the world. So really, for a lot of these individuals, and there are many other investigators out there who will tell you this, that one of the only ways these individuals have to ever put the truth out is to do it through a proxy. They find another individual, or another individual finds them, and they talk a little bit about what they know. They're usually very, very careful when they talk about it because they don't want trails leading right back to them. With this gentleman, I think a great deal of his openness had to do with the fact that he knew he was dying, and he knew that he was just fed up with the government's behavior. So he was more than willing, knowing that I had understood at least a little bit of what was going on. He was much more willing to open up.
On November 20th, 1969, the Apollo 12 astronauts did an experiment with some strange results. They crashed the lunar module ascent stage into the surface of the moon. Shockwaves reverberated throughout the moon for over an hour. Some have likened this to ringing like a bell. These results were repeated during the Apollo 13 mission. However, this time the shockwaves lasted for over 3 hours. Hollow moon researchers say that this is proof that the interior of the moon was hollowed out by artificial means. MIT's Dr. Sean C. Solomon wrote, "The lunar orbiter experiments vastly improved our knowledge of the moon's gravitational field, indicating the frightening possibility that the moon might be hollow." On March 7, 1971, instruments placed on the moon by the Apollo astronauts recorded a cloud of water vapor passing over the surface. The event lasted for over 14 hours and covered an area of at least 100 square miles. The Earth is thought to be around 4.6 billion years old, while rocks from the moon were found to be around 5.3 billion years old. And the dust the rocks were found in is thought to be about a billion years older than that. This information conflicts with the theory that the moon was produced by a collision the Earth had with another body earlier in its history.
One of the things that you've got to keep in mind as well when you're looking at NASA imagery is that although the sky may appear black in those frames, in many instances, when you enhance that image, you discover that there's actually an incredible amount of image detail that's just buried in the darkness of that image. But when you amplify that scene and you begin to see what's hidden there in the sky, you can begin to make out shapes. There's a few images that show structuring. And this is all done in an effort to both hide the truth, but as well to leave a bit of the truth there for you. And again, a lot of people don't want to believe they do that, but they do. That's all part of the dripping faucet technique, where they give you tiny little bits of the truth, and you can begin to fill it in, put it together for yourself. One of the frames that really, really demonstrates the way they use this dripping faucet technique is a frame known as 20680 from the Apollo 17 mission. For 30 years, this frame was listed, officially listed in their catalogs in the Apollo 17 Photographic Index, as being a blank, no image data frame, a frame that has got nothing on it. While this image is most definitely sunstruck and overexposed, blank it most certainly is not.
Harrison Schmitt, you know, created some patches for his own mission, Apollo 17, which is, again, the mission that we take this image from, these images from, and that we've seen a lot of this color effect. And what he put on it was Stonehenge and the sun. And the sun is a symbol of ancient Egyptian god Horus. There's all sorts of Egyptian mythology that runs through all the Apollo program, which is supposed to be Greek, but it ends up that there's really sort of a dual meaning to all this stuff, and it's an Egyptian. And what he's saying is, what he's clearly saying to people is, look, these are ruins. There is structure. This is what we're really doing on the moon. And I think what they're doing is they're trying in a subtle way to let people know, either because they remember it subconsciously or because they are deliberately trying to send us messages under the radar, that they did not go there and pick up a bunch of rocks, but instead what they brought back, or what they were sent to investigate, was ancient extraterrestrial ruins.
One of the most important things to keep in mind whenever you're looking at any NASA imagery, whether it's Apollo imagery or imagery of Mars, it doesn't really matter. Perspective is everything. We human beings down here on terra firma are afforded one perspective of the moon. We look at it, and that's what we have to look at. We don't know what the moon looks like from the side or from different oblique angles. All we have is this singular representation that we have to look at. And NASA has, in fact, gone to great lengths to ensure that the imagery that they show us of the moon's surface resembles very closely, both in photometric function as well as in angling. And the dimensional properties of the image make it appear as if it would look just like it does from Earth. One of the primary obfuscation techniques that NASA uses is to simply rotate the imagery. They insert a false horizon in their oblique imagery, so by turning these images upside down, it alters vertical objects, suddenly don't cast shadows anymore, the shadows aren't in the right places, and this technique has been used since the dawn of the space age. Since the lunar orbiter missions, since even before that with Ranger missions, to make things appear as we humans expect them to appear, because we look through a telescope here, we say, oh, that's how it looks. So from the side, it probably looks like this. The reality is it doesn't. The moon is a very three-dimensional object.
Hasselblad cameras were the ones that were used by NASA to photograph everything on the moon. And the reason the Hasselblad was used is because they had registration crosshairs. Now, these registration crosshairs are there for a specific reason, okay? They're so that you can take a single photo with a single camera, so you'll be able to get distance from an object to another object because of the registration crosshairs that are built into the Hasselblad cameras. These crosshairs are always in front of whatever's being photographed. Okay, this is a perfect shot of a photograph of one of the astronauts on the moon. Now here you see the crosshairs from the Hasselblad camera. Okay? You can clearly see that they are even in the darkness of space, but you can clearly see that the crosshairs are there in exactly the positions they should be. So in a lot of the false horizons, they've eliminated the crosshairs in the sky parts. And almost about 90% of the moon shots have what we call a false horizon.
In 1999, William Burroughs wrote a book called This New Ocean. It's a non-fictional account, supposedly non-fictional account, of the space race. If you look at the cover of that book, you'll notice that he has a picture of the Earth's horizon on it with the moon above. And on the cover of this book, there are two black running parallel lines that climb up from the Earth, and they pass the moon on either side, paralleling it. It's interesting when you go and look at the ISS and space shuttle imagery of the moon from low Earth orbit. When you begin to enhance those images and begin to attack the black area of the sky that appears to be solid black, and there are different filtering techniques you can use to draw that out, you begin to realize that those lines that are on the cover of this book actually are appearing in these photographs. And they don't appear once or twice. You don't see this effect once or twice. You see this in many, many, many dozens of photographs. They're just of the moon. They appear when you enhance the image. And obviously Burroughs knows something that the public's not privy to. He's really just a classic outsider-insider, very much like Andrew Chaikin is. He's a guy who knows what the truth is, but has agreed to perpetuate the lie rather than to reveal what the truth is, for a whole variety of reasons.
Burroughs does a fantastic job of presenting to us exactly the propaganda and the storyline that the powers that be have been selling us as being the truth for decades. And he gives the reader the official historical cover story in brilliant details. He's someone who is most definitely in the know. There are also frames in which some of these lines appear to be behind the moon, where you see the line rising up and being cut off as it hits the lower limb of the moon before re-emerging again on the exact opposite side of that intersection point where it continues on its very straight linear path. And in these cases, you can see that the lines do not transit in front of or across the lunar disk, but rather it's the opposite. The moon appears to be transiting and covering these lines. So what's going on here? Why do all these NASA ISS frames of the moon taken from LEO show these parallel lines, and why does this book cover mimic this same visual? What are we seeing, and what is being represented? One hypothesis I've heard has to do with what are called space elevators, which, as the name implies, are elevator transport systems that can be used to lift things, satellites, cargo, spacecraft, people, from the surface of the Earth, lift those up into space. Now, yeah, I realize that to many people, this idea of building elevators with lengths of tens of thousands of kilometers that could extend from the Earth's surface up to geostationary orbit or to the moon probably sounds ludicrous, something that, if it is possible at all, must be centuries and centuries beyond what we're capable of doing today. But it really does not seem to be as beyond state-of-the-art as one might think. These are the kind of projects being worked on today and funded today. Back in 1999, NASA sponsored what was called the Space Elevator Workshop, and its purpose was to explore the feasibility of the development of space elevators in the 21st century. And it discusses plans for construction that would take place during the later half of the century. And that's all the unclassified stuff. That is what they're willing to tell us about their capabilities.
Were the Egyptian pharaohs and clergymen of their time aware of subterranean places that had celestial functions? Judging by hieroglyphics that were discovered in tombs of pharaohs, such as Ramses, one can see a collaboration between what the Egyptians described in their time as a stairway to heaven and what we are seeing now with these space elevators emanating from Earth.
The Vector, NASA's official logo. If you've ever looked at NASA's official logo, both their official insignia and their official seal, you'll see that the most prominent object in the seal is a red swooshing object. They call that the chevron or the vector. If you ask NASA's public affairs office that this symbology is featured so heavily in their insignia and seal, they'll give you what really amounts to the standard facile cover story for the unilluminated. They'll tell you that that is a representation of a hypersonic wing design from the 1950s, which was the time the logo was created. Not exactly the case. Someone might want to ask the Russian Federal Space Agency, Roscosmos, that was formed in 1992, why they chose that same logo. And while you're at it, you can ask the Chinese, who formed their space agency in 1996, why in the world they're using a hypersonic wing design from the 1950s as their official logo. Then you can ask the Japanese, the South Koreans, Taiwanese, Malaysia, Mexico, Iran, all of these countries, even Bulgaria. They all utilize the vector symbology in their space agency logos for their national space agencies. It gets even deeper. You can go look at the individual manned program patches for NASA. The Mercury program, for example, a blatant use of covert symbology. In every logo dealing with the Mercury program, you'll see what looks like a number 7 in their logo. And again, NASA's official story is that they put this number 7 there so that they could pay homage to the original 7 Mercury astronauts, kind of forgetting the fact that only 6 Mercury astronauts actually flew into space, because number 7 never did. Deke Slayton had a heart problem, so he didn't get to go up. So there were only
6 Mercury astronauts. Yet there's a 7 in every single logo. That's in the official mission insignia, or official program insignia for Mercury, as well as the 6 individual mission patches carrying this logo. And it carries on to the space shuttle program. If you look at the Apollo logo, the Apollo logo has a big letter A in it. At least that's what they want you to believe. But it's not. Again, that's just a simple way of explaining away the inclusion of this vector symbology in the logo. If you go to the space shuttle program, the original space shuttle STS program patch is a triangular patch that, again, hides the use of the chevronic vector symbology. And that also goes for many of the STS-specific mission patches. Every single one of the International Space Station expedition patches carry the vector symbology. The Russian Mir Space Station used the vector symbology. That was their official logo. And you can even go deeper and look at military industrial complex companies. Look at the logo on a company like Lockheed Martin, 2 vectors. The XPRIZE logo, Ames Research Labs, the U.S. Space Command, when you get into the military realm, the United States Space Command, their official logo is the vector symbol. And when you look at the military's individual space-specific programs, all of them deal with vector symbology in their official insignias. And the question really becomes, who or what are these people paying homage to? And the truth, quite frankly, is out of this world.
Entitled The Madonna with St. Giovannino, was made sometime during the 1400s. The artist's name is not known, but at first glance, you can notice a UFO shape in the sky to the right side of the Madonna. If you were to see the original full-size painting, you would see the object clearly. Looking at the enlargement, you can see a man and his dog standing and looking up at the object. However, this painting has something else being depicted. On the left side of the painting, you see the sun and some vector-like objects seemingly flying from or toward the sun. Perhaps this artist was trying to tell us something. In another painting of the Madonna made by a completely different artist, the unusual patterns of the sun and the vector-like symbols have also been added prominently on the Madonna's cloak. You can see the same symbology on this painting as on the one before. This time, however, there is no UFO object to be seen anywhere in the sky. This footage was taken over Mexico City in 2002. There were many other videos and photographs taken of this same type of object, clearly resembling the shapes as seen on the visor of the astronaut, on the moon, and depicted in the 14th century paintings of the Madonna and Child. There is probably a larger story behind the vectors, but it is very unusual this symbology has been adapted by all the United States and foreign space agencies, especially enemies like Iran and others who are also making missions to the moon.
Houston, switching now to the voice of Jim Lovell. 16.5, good to hear your voice. Apollo 8, Houston, what does the old moon look like from 60 miles, over?
Okay, Houston, the moon is essentially gray, no color.
Exactly 2 weeks before I finished editing the first version of Moon Rising, I found out that there's a website on the USGS, it's the United States Geological Survey website, where they have the moon in different colors. They have it on grayscale. They have it on false color, which is infrared and ultraviolet views of the moon. But they also have the spectral color, which is full natural color of the moon. And when I found this out, I just totally freaked out. I mean, first of all, when I airbrushed the moon to build the poster for my film, I didn't realize how close I was to the actual natural colors of the moon. My partner Saskia, she goes, Jose, are you sure you haven't been on the moon? Because it was so close, it was just amazing.
It's so unbelievably beautiful. All these natural colors that exist out there has never been shown to us. I've seen on TV, the moon is gray and black, and it has no color. Well, that couldn't be farther from the truth. It's compelling. I just want to see more, and it blew me away. It absolutely blew me away.
First of all, with the Clementine mission, it took 1.8 million images of the moon. The high-resolution ones, you can't seem to get any of them because, well, they give you different reasons why you can't get them, but you can't seem to get them. But there's also these natural color images, and they are much, much brighter. They have far more color than they should if our models of the moon are correct. Now, there's two ways you can approach this. One is it could very well be that some of these areas, let's say some of these areas under these glass structures, these domes, are still intact, that there's still atmosphere in there, that there is still stuff growing there. You know, you would obviously have plants and vegetation, you have various things there that you would need to survive or that you would have simply for the aesthetics of living in an environment with plants and animals. So it's possible that's what some of this stuff is. Another distinct possibility, and this is the one that I tend to advocate, is that if you really do have these multiple layers of glass structures all over the moon, what's going to happen is the light is going to scatter and bounce all over the place. And when it does that, you get a prism effect, and it then will combine with other red or green or blue, and it will make other colors.
In order to comprehend the significance about the natural color of the moon, you need to know where these images come from. This is what is called the skin of the moon. It is the actual surface that has been stretched and flattened out. When visual artists wrap this skin around a sphere in their 3D programs, this is what you get. Jose Escamilla downloaded hundreds of sections of the entire skin that is available on the USGS website. The area of interest is in this section here, located on the front side of the moon. When Jose zoomed into this particular section, he recognized some very unusual features and objects in the scene. First of all, the terrain below is clearly presenting itself at an angular view. The disc shape located here appears to be hovering above the surface. When you compare this disc with others that are closer to the terrain, you can clearly see this object is not down on the terrain. Jose found out very quickly that there are more of these discs all over the moon. The discs that you will see in other photos we are going to present are identical to this one. They are hovering on their sides, and sometimes they are hovering as these others below. The other discs you will see are different in color and details, but they are shining light onto the lunar surface as they do whatever they are doing close to the terrain. In all the photos Jose presents in this film, you are seeing the only clear and detailed photography ever released in full color of real flying saucers. NASA has known this, and so have the multitudes of people connected to the space program.
Another thing that I need to bring forth is, in my first film, UFO, the Greatest Story Ever Denied, we had this whole segment on the STS footage of the things that are flying near the tether, things that have the donut hole, but they seem to be alive. I've come to find out that these things are thriving on the moon's surface. There's thousands of them. And they're hovering above the moon's surface. Finding the full color imagery that you're looking at now, the natural colors of the moon, it brings us to a total new reality that the moon could have been teeming with life back in 1994 when these photos were taken, or it may still be teeming with life.
Thank you.
And the truth is, once you look at these pictures of the moon or Mars, and you realize that this stuff is structure, that there's artificial structures there, pretty much everything is on the table.
There are so many lunar landscapes filled with color and textures unlike anything ever seen before with the human eye. There are deep crevices and overhangs where you can see immensely huge openings or what appear to be cavern entrances. There are far too many gigantic and massive structures as can be described. You have to see them for yourself in order to grasp the size of these complex and in most cases alien-like architecture as you have seen in many films. You will even see some strange vine-like webbing as depicted in Steven Spielberg's War of the Worlds. Glass domes, UFOs, massive buildings, and scaffolding spread throughout the lunar terrain in many sizes, shapes, and forms. It is evident the missions to the moon were more involved than gathering rocks and dirt samples. There is no doubt we went to the moon. It is what was waiting for us when we got there that this film is about.
Finding the full color imagery that you're looking at now, the natural colors of the moon, it brings us to a total new reality that the moon could have been teeming with life back in 94 when these photos were taken, or it may still be teeming with life.
I think they are still there. They were there in the 70s when the last Apollo mission was there. I found lights on.
It seems that at least in some areas of the moon that the lights might still be on.
We're talking about the covering up of hyper-advanced technology that could do away with fossil fuels, our dependence on fossil fuels. We're talking about technology that allows for much quicker transport through space than we've ever been told.
What I think has happened is that all these other countries somehow have found out that we went there, that we brought back this technology, that we're exploiting this technology. And they want a piece of the action. So that's why, it's the only reason why they would spend the kind of money that they're spending, India, China, all these, Japan, all these countries, to go back to the moon. To what? To collect rocks? No, they're going back there because there's something incredibly valuable there that they know that we have, the United States brought back, that they want a piece of. And it's a tremendous risk. You know, there's not just simply the risk to the astronauts' lives. There's, if you believe some of the stories, there's even a risk to, other people that might already be there.
In the end result, I have found that the moon is in full color. It's not a black and white object. It's not made of, impact craters and this kind of thing. There's a lot more to it. NASA has deliberately tampered a lot of the photography. They've eliminated the crosshairs to eliminate what was in the background in the sky or in the landscapes. And there are some very significant things that have occurred. All we say, we don't know the answers.
You know, in this whole realm, none of us, none of these individual researchers, not necessarily Jose, not Richard and I, we don't have all the answers. We all have a piece of the puzzle. We all see different parts of it. And there's certain aspects of this that we're all good at.
All I'm presenting to you, and it's backed up with facts, all my films present to you with evidence that is fully acknowledged. You can backtrace it. You can do, as they say, back engineer everything I present. It's all there for you to see.
What we do know is that there's more information out there. Again, there's 1.8 million Clementine images sitting on the web. No one person can access even a handful of those and look at them and study them and find stuff on them. So what we need is for people that see these films and see documentaries like this is to understand that this stuff does exist. They can't hide it all.
When I was talking with the gentleman from Belcom, and we were discussing the lie, everything he was telling me was different from what we were being told was the truth. And at one point I asked him, I said, man, you guys, you lied about a lot, didn't you? And instantly he said, no, we didn't lie about certain things. We lied about everything. None of it was true.
Thank you. have vowed that we shall not be governed by a hostile flag of conquest, but by a banner of freedom and peace. We have vowed that we shall not see space filled with weapons of mass destruction, but with instruments of knowledge and understanding. Yet the vows of this nation can only be fulfilled if we in this nation are first, and therefore we intend to be first.
Right, so what I want to do now, everybody, is share with you from the Agni Purana. Now, I was able to research this, and I found in a book that this Purana, written by the fire god Agni, was actually Ashtar. In some books, this is referred to as the Ashtar Vidya, or that translates as Ashtar's knowledge. And the fire god would have been Ashtar, and we can see that he shoots beams of fire out of his palms. That's the violet flame, and that's coming from his heart. Agni, the fire god, is the first son of Brahma, and some other sons of Brahma are Sanat Kumara, Sanaka Kumara, Sananda Kumara, and Agni wrote this book, and most of the copies are available only in Sanskrit. If you go online and you look up Agni Purana, you're going to find copies of it, but it's only 41 pages and it's a summary of the 900-page book. In the actual copy, there are illustrations, and those can't be found online unless you look at the Sanskrit version. There was another book written by a scholar on Hindu traditions, and he extrapolated and explained how they had figured out that the Agni Purana itself, the first time it was written down in recorded form, was over 2 million years ago. So when I read it to you, it may read like Hindu scripture, but I wouldn't think of it that way if I were you. This version is translated from Sanskrit, so there's Sanskrit words in it. And it's going to it refers to the gods of the time as Krishna and Vishnu, but those are the same Greek gods that were Apollo and Zeus, and Juno was Mother Sekhmet, who was also known as Hera. So the Greek names and the Roman names and the Hindu names are different, but they're all the same people riding across the chariots in the sky. And so when the fire god came down from his UFO and landed and taught Visheshtra these teachings, then he sat around and told the rishis these teachings, and eventually in time the whole thing was written down. So the copy I have, I bought. I had to import it from New Delhi, India. It's very rare, it's hard to find. And so I'm reading my copy. It's a rare copy. This is a used book that I just sent away for because I was so stoked that I had Ashtar's book, that I could literally buy it and read it. And you cannot find it in English on the internet. I looked at university sites and library sites, and I looked the world over, and I couldn't find it, so I had to buy it. So I hope you enjoy this. I'm going to read from all four sections because it's such a rare treat. And so I hope you just sit back and relax because you can't get this anywhere else. Enjoy. This first part I'm going to read you. Just trying to adjust my lighting here. This first part I'm going to read you is called Mode of Purification of the Principle of Peace. So this is Ashtar speaking, and he's explaining to the rishis what to do to get their bodies in the mode of the Principle of Peace. If we really take these advisories seriously and apply them to our lives, it is the true Rishi God on Earth teachings of how to live our lives, how to live pure lives and save the planet, not kill each other, and have peace. This was written since before the last flood. I hope it gets followed this time. Chapter 87, Mode of Purification of the Principle of Peace. And Ashtar said, the beatific knowledge should be united now with the principle of peace as laid down. The two principles lie in the principle of peace. Bahavasvara and Sadajiva are spoken as these two letters, Ha and Kesa. Remember, this is translated from the Sanskrit. If it was translated from another language, those would be different words. So don't let that throw you off. The Rudras are equal in number to the worlds. They are as follows. Valiant, time, little, free from impurity, auspicious, heavy, unstained form, auspicious to himself, cause of brilliance, Lord of the 30 gods, representing the 30, known as the time, minute, and Lord of the Lotus. These are the Rudas firmly established in the principle of peace. Obsession to the one who pervades the ether, to the form which manifests as the ether, to the all-pervasive, to the auspicious one, to the endless, to one who has no matter, to one who is not having any hold, to the firm one, to the eternal, to the one firmly established in the seat of yoga, to the eternal yogin, and one who partakes of such meditation of votaries, they're the 12 terms used in their invocation. The preceptor should meditate with the two protective mantras known as Bindu and Upadraka. The two occult nerves, Alambusa and Siasa, and the two vital winds, Karakara and Kumaka, in the subtle phase. The organs of the skin and hand are considered as the two senses of perception for this beatific principle. The attributes of touch and sound are the only two attributes. Lord Siva is the only cause of these. Having contemplated upon the different worlds which are located in the beatific principle of peace as the fourth state of consciousness in which the soul gets united with the Supreme Being, the preceptor should do the act of gentle beating, division, entry, and union. Having drawn the beatific principle of peace from the string of the face, it should be held by the preceptor. Having merged it in one's own self, the beatific principle should be held and projected in the receptacle. O Lord, I am initiating this disciple, desirous of release from bondage, subject to your control. You have to be beneficial to him. The appeal should thus be made. After having invoked the divine parents, and doing the gentle beating of the disciple, etc., and collecting the soul force, it should be united with its preceptor's own soul. Having invoked the divine parents as before, by showing mudra, known as ubhava, formation with fingers denoting generation, it should be located in the womb of the goddess by repeating the principal mantra of the god preceded by the mantras of the heart. A corporeal frame of the beatitude should be done with the repetition of mantra of the heart 5 times. The mantra of the head should be repeated for bringing it into being. Its authority is accomplished by the mantra of the tuft and enjoyment of the mantra of the amour. Its repose is accomplished by the repetition of the mantra of weapons. The purification of the currents is achieved by that of Lord Siva. In the case of purification of the principle, the rites of Garbhadhana, etc., should be done in the same manner as before. The thread is untied with that of the amour. Having completed the purification thus, one should repeat the mantras 100 times. In order to compensate the mitigation of the power of mantras, 5 oblations should be made with the mantra of the weapon. After having untied the thread, it should be severed with a knife by the repetition of the mantra of the weapon 7 times, just as the bondage is cut off with the principal mantra. The mantra is Om Hum to the thread of the beatific principle of peace, Ha Hum Fat, after having untied and made into a circle. The cord should be placed as before in the sacrificial ladle filled with clarified butter with the repetition of the mantra. The god should bid adieu, and the crescent-like soul should be united with the Lord Rudra. Then it must be united with one's owner, the preceptor's soul, in the prescribed way. The same should be united with the thread by showing pure Abhava Mudra, formation with fingers denoting generation. The drop of nectar should be put on the head of the disciple with the repetition of the principal mantra. Having taken leave of the divine parents after worshipping them with flowers, etc., the preceptor should offer the final oblation to the fire as a concluding rite. Even here, the acts of gentle beating, etc., should be done as before. The distinctive feature is the use of its principal mantra. Thus, purification of the beatific principle of peace is done without any impediment. Okay, now I want to read to you an explanation of what the book is. These are 4 different books, so let me find it. All right. This is how I was able to identify that Ashtar had really had originally taught these, and that this one, Agni Purana, is named for him and him alone. This is the very ending, and it explains what this is. Hence, O Vyasa, this Purana, making everything explicit, should always be read to the disciples in the company of the sages, such as Sukha, and others who are desirous of hearing the Agniya Purana. Agniya, in other references, is referring to Ashtar. Read and contemplated would be auspicious and confer enjoyment and emancipation, obeisance to that fire god who has sung the Purana. O Sutta, redactor, this Agneya Purana, which is of the form of para and aparavidya, and the supreme position was sung by the sage Vasistha is the one who Ashtar gave a one-on-one teaching to by coming down from, beaming down from the UFO. So this was not an incarnation of Ashtar on Earth. Vasistha in Days of Yore, and it has been expounded to you by me. The fortunate ones would attain a form difficult to get. Those who meditate upon this Agneya Purana, the Brahman, who would reach Lord Hari, that's another name for Vishnu. Those who seek knowledge would get knowledge. Those who wish for kingdom would obtain kingdom. Those without progeny get children. Those without resort would reach a resort. Those who seek fortune and those who desire for liberation get them. Those who transcribe and those who cause it to be transcribed become sinless and gain fortune. O Sutta, think of the form of Agnya Purna, expounded by Sukha, Palya, and others. There is no doubt that you would gain enjoyment and emancipation. You recite the Purana to the disciples and devotees. That's true, right? That's what Ashtar's come here to do, to emancipate us, to give us our freedom back, and help us gain the desires of our hearts by having peace. I have heard the Agni Purana with respect by the favor of Vyasu. The Agni Purana is a manifestation of the Supreme Brahman. You and other sages, such as Sanaka and others, had worshipped Lord Hari in the Nemissu forest. They were steadfast. The Agni Purana is spoken by Agni and conforms to the Vedas. This Purana, endowed with the two sorts of Brahmavidya, confers enjoyment and emancipation. There is nothing richer in substance than this. Nothing is a better friend than this. There is no greater work than this. There is no better course than this. There is no greater trustees than this. There is no greater scripture than this. There is no superior knowledge than this. That's how they describe these books that Ashtar wrote. And this is what is taught to the rishis in India today. Okay, the next section I want to read from the Agni Purana is a description of the lunar race. This is a kind of a kind of a genealogy like they have in Genesis, but these are the UFO commanders that they're naming. Check it out. I won't read all of it. I'll just read a brief capture so you can get a feeling for what was written here. It's fascinating. The fire god said, that's Ashtar, I shall describe the lunar race. It would destroy the sin of one who reads it. Brahma was born from the navel lotus of Lord Vishnu, the sage. Atri was the son of Brahma. Soma was born from Atri. Soma performed the Raja Suya sacrifice and gave away the suzerainty over the three worlds as the fees for the priest. When the final bathing was finished, the wives of the mortals who desired to look at his beautiful form served him, being tormented by the arrows of the god of love. Goddess Lakshmi deserted Lord Nararana, Sinavali, Diyuti, Pushti, Prabha, Kuhu, Kirti, Vasu, and Jyoti respectively deserted Kardama. Vihavasu, the undecaying Jyata, Prabhakara, Avisman, the husband, Jayanta, Marsha Kalyapa, and husband Nandi, and entertain Soma alone then. Soma also bestowed his affection on them as if they were his wives. The husbands of these women were not able to curse him or punish him with the weapons, although he had done a misdeed, as he had obtained suzerainty over the seven worlds by means of a penance. So what are they talking about here? They're talking about the gods who went to Earth and mated with the human women and shared their DNA with them. And Mother Sekhmet always mentions to us that the gods did things wrong back then. That's why the world was flooded again. And this is telling us that story. It's the same story in the Book of Enoch. It's in our Bible, and it's in the Hindu Puranas. Being influenced by their submission, his mind faltered. Soma seduced hastily the glorious Tara, the wife of Braspati, the preceptor of the Celestials. They're saying, you know, these are the ETs. And thus insulted the son of Agures, Rapati. On account of this incident, there was the battle, well known as Tara Kamaya, involving the Celestials, between the Celestials and demons, causing great destruction to the world. This was the war where there was fighting in the skies. The spacecraft were flying around and shooting beams of fire, lightning, and nuclear weapons, and bombing the Earth and bombing each other in the skies. This story is told in several of the creation stories as well as the Bible. Brahma intervened and prevailed upon Usanas, preceptor of the demons, to shed his wrath, and entrusted Tara to the care of Agures, who was Braspati. Guru Braspati, finding her pregnant, said to her, "Shed the child in the womb." The child that was delivered was effulgent and said, "I am the son of the moon." Thus Buddha was born from Soma. Puruvas was his son. The nymph Urvasi deserted heaven and was enamored of him. O great sage, the king 59 years with her. There was only one fire in days of yore, which was made into three by him. Pururavas practiced yoga and reached the world of the Gandharavas. Urvasi, wife of Puruvas, gave birth to the kings Ayas, Dradyas, Asvayas, Ganayas, Jitraman, Vasu, Divijata, and Satayulyas. Okay, you get the gist. It goes on and on. But I just wanted to show you how Ashtar was explaining over 2 million years ago the same story we have in Enoch. Same exact story. He also told that same story when he was Pakovutan. He wrote that story down in the Popol Vuh. That's what the Popol Vuh is about also. Lots of people read the Popol Vuh today and they think they read about cheetahs and the House of Swords and they were playing ball in the courtyard, and everyone says, "What is this story about?" And, well, Ashtar very clearly said those were stories about the Orion Wars, and it was also stories about what it was like living in the antimatter universe before we incarnated into human bodies. It's all the same story being told again and again, hoping that mankind won't kill themselves off again. So let me see this other section. I wanted to share with you this part because Ashtar explains about the mode for reciting the Gayatri and its greatness. The Gayatri mantra is something that is revered in India as maybe one of the most important mantras you can do. So let me read with you quickly what this says. The fire god said, "One who knows the syllable Om is verily a yogin and the Lord Hari. Hence one should practice the syllable Om. That is the essence of all sacred syllables and the giver of all things." Remember, in John 1:1 in the Bible it says, the word was God and God was with the Word. I'm saying it wrong. What John was talking about was the word Om. Om is the beginning sound of all creation. It is the divine blueprint. The pranava om is known to be the first in the application of all the sacred syllables. Hence, the act which becomes complete with that will not get completed with any other syllable. There are three great unmutilated vaharitras syllables which are preceded by the syllable om. The three-footed savitra, gayatra, should be known as the face of Lord Brahma. One who unwearily repeats these every day 3 years reaches the supreme Brahman, becoming the wind and embodying the sky. I think that means you can levitate and fly around and go out of body and maybe teletransport, right? Just have to sing Om every day for 3 years. That's how sacred it is. The one syllable is the supreme Brahma, and pranayama, control of the birth, in the supreme penance. There is nothing greater than savrita. Truthfulness excels silence. The repetition of the gayatra 7 times would destroy one's sins, and 10 times would convey the person to heaven. That goddess, repeated 20 times, would convey him to the abode of Lord Shiva. One would cross the ocean of mundane existence by repeating it 108 times. The gayatra excels the repetition of Kudra, of Rudra, and Kusmanda, the mantras in its merit. There is nothing excelling gayatra for repetition. There is nothing equal to vyatras for doing ablutions. The quarter of the hymn, or half of it, or half the hymn, or the whole hymn being repeated, purifies one of the sins, such as killing of a Brahmin, drinking of wine, stealing of gold, or cohabitating with the preceptor's wife. And for those of you who are not familiar with the gayatra, I just want to play it briefly for you. Just let me get it up here. It'll just take a second. Oh, sorry, 1 second. Here it is. I'm just going to play a few seconds of it. Maybe you've heard it before. Okay, so that's the mantra that Ashtar is referring to in the book. In English, an interpretation is this: O God, giver of life, remover of all pain and sorrows, bestower of happiness, the creator of the universe, thou art most luminous, adorable, and destroyer of sins. We meditate upon thee. May thou inspire, enlighten, and guide our intellect in the right direction. It can also be known as the right understanding, or to the holy seat, or to the universe. And basically what it's saying is that you are asking God to merge with you, and it helps you remember that you are God. And so he's saying when you recognize this and you meditate on it, that's what brings you those austere revisions. All right, so what I want to do now is move on to Ashtar's only earth incarnation as Paco Votan in Maya. And he wrote the Popol Vuh in that lifetime, which loosely translates as the people. In the Popol Vuh is a creation story, and there are mythical twins. And if we look at it from the standpoint that those twins are Enkian and Lil, the the renegade reptilians from Nibiru who came in and mixed their DNA with the humans, then the Popol Vuh starts to make a little bit more sense. I want to read to you a bit of what I wrote about it so you can get the flavor of it. The Popol Vuh is recorded history of the Galactic Federation, beginning with the Earth's first creation and destruction. The second Earth creation and destruction, which occurred in the antimatter universe. It goes on to tell the Earth's third creation, when Earth fell into the 12th dimension after a nuclear disaster in the higher dimensions. The third Earth creation, we took on physical bodies. The Popol Vuh details the Zebalbal lords of death from the Orion War and the resulting colonization of Earth. He tells the story of Enkian and Lil, and the alteration in the DNA races at Earth. These intergalactic crimes were heard at the Solar Tribunal, and a decision was made. He finishes by explaining how the Lords of Light came to the Palenque area and reestablished peace on Earth, and had a long reign. Poco Votan is Ashtar's only Earth incarnation, and that is when he wrote the Popol Vuh. So, I'm not going to share any more of that right now, because when you read the Popol Vuh from that standpoint, it's really clear what's happening there. If you're thinking of it as literally happening in the physical, that's when you get lost. So now I want to move on and tell you about this other book. This book was channeled in the 1950s, and it came from Ashtar to a lady who wrote down these letters that Ashtar wrote to each one of us. And it's so interesting. Let me see. I have to bring up the file. One second. Where did I put it? Okay, here. It's at the end. So, I see why it's long. Just bear with me. I'm almost there. Okay. In Days to Come by Ashtar. This is a series of messages from an extraterrestrial named Ashtar, transmitted through automatic writing. Ashtar was apparently channeled by Ethel P. Hill, an early UFO contactee, in 1955. Ashtar claims to be the commander of a vast army of spacemen. He apparently reports directly to Jesus Christ, who, it is implied, will return at some point in a UFO. In the book, I show a fresco that's in Kiev on the church wall of the transfiguration of Jesus on Mount Hermon. And in the fresco, it shows Jesus being beamed down in the blue beam from the New Jerusalem. And the John and James and Peter are all on the floor asleep because they couldn't handle the heavy energy. And Jesus comes back in his glowy body. And Elijah and Moses beam down from the ship just to, you know, have a chat with the boys. I love that. let me read a little bit of, give you a sample of what Ashtar wrote in the 1950s. I just want to scroll down to a spot. Everything that Ashtar is saying through channels nowadays is the same message he was giving back in the 1950s. He said it in a different language back then. It was a little more, sheltered of a message. He talked about the Dark Ones, but not in the detail that he does now. And he asked everyone to be aware and that know that Jesus was coming back to bring heaven to earth, and that Sananda never gave up on us, and he was going to keep his promise. And he explains the masses of the Galactic Federation and what we can expect. It's a delightful book. I'll just read a part where I am describing the book. In Chapter 3, Ashtar begins by explaining their presence and their purpose. He makes sure to remind us that although they are here now to combat the vast dark forces as we make the necessary changes for landings, that there is an intention of a much more joyous mission. Ashtar said, "When we mingle freely with you and gladly initiate you into many delights and privileges we possess," Ashtar's twin flame is now incarnate on Earth. She works in private and she knows who she is. There are many claiming to be her on the internet, and none that do are. Ashtar has conveyed to me how much he looks forward to a time when he can return to Earth to be with his family and live life here. Likewise, his crew have their families here. These are our galactic families, and there are 20 million I know of surrounding Earth now. Delights and privileges. There are so many new technologies that will delight us. Healing machines, replicators, which can produce anything we need with no store necessary. Shuttlecraft, computers which prepare any food we desire, serve to perfection with no grocery store or washing dishes necessary. Drudgery will disappear. No need to go to our old jobs because we will not need the things we are working for now. Slavery will end. The privileges of training for the mission you desire the most, especially in the holodeck programs. The list of delights and privileges is endless, including intergalactic travel to home at will without a need for a travel agent. Ashtar speaks of the earth changes designed by Mother Gaia to heal the destruction that had harmed her, especially the effects of nuclear holocaust. About this, he says, "We realize certain portions of earthly terrain are marked for destruction. In pursuance of this program, we withhold interference when so instructed by the hierarchy, in uninterrupted touch with the Father of us all. When certain prearranged signals are received, we send thousands of ventilas to places where dangerous conditions exist." Here Ashtar speaks of the fact that Mother Earth, also called Gaia, made a clarion call to our Father in Heaven that all destruction inside her and on her surface be stopped. As soon as the nuclear weapons at Japan were unleashed, it allowed the Galactic Federation to intervene in higher ways than before to protect the planet from the deadly forces who would destroy her. This was allowed for the highest good of all involved. That's a little sample, and the book is a couple of hundred pages long. It's a wonderful read, and it will hearken your heart for the adventures to come. Ashtar goes into great detail in this book about what the plan is about and how they're going to carry it out and why they're here doing it. And there's a message from Sananda in the book too. So that is pretty much what I have There's more in the book than that, but I specifically focused on these three works from Ashtar that he wrote. The Popol Vuh, In Days to Come, and the Agni Purana. So it gives us enlightenment so much more than really what's out there on the web about who Ashtar is. And it shows the resounding themes in all of his work repeat themselves. And so I hope you really enjoy the book. I hope you'll run out tomorrow morning and get a copy of it. I'm going to make it available as an ebook immediately. And it is submitted to become a book published. And so I have to wait for them to mail me a copy so I can approve it. I can approve the cover and the look of it and that everything's fine with it. So as soon as that's returned in the mail, then it will be ready for sale on Amazon and other places. So I hope you enjoy it, and I hope, I dream that this means that we're very, very close now. Ashtar asked me to do this project, and it was a great honor. So thank you for letting me share that with you tonight. Now what I'd like to do is an encore performance. There is a part two to the video that we listened to earlier, and it's really great. So I want to share it with you tonight, and we'll do a little bit of an overflow, and when it's ready for the next guest, then the video should be finishing up. So enjoy it, everybody. Thank you for being here with me. Thank you for your continued donations. They're very much needed and very much appreciated. Please help me keep going. I'm working very, very hard to put out the information. Please go to my other website at www.cosmicascension.com and look, there's some new things there. And thank you to my volunteers who work with me every week with the moderation at the website. And thank you to the volunteers who help me proofreading the books and getting the artwork out. Have a great night, everybody. Much love to you. I'm going to pull up this video, so enjoy it. Thank you. Good night.
Tenth Planet, Discovered, presented by Science at NASA. Astronomers have found a new planet in the outer reaches of the solar system. July 29, 2005. It's definitely bigger than Pluto. So says Dr. Mike Brown of the California Institute of Technology, who announced today the discovery of a new planet in the outer solar system. The planet, which has not been officially named, was found by Brown and colleagues using the Samuel Ossian Telescope at Palomar Observatory near San Diego. The planet is currently about 97 times farther from the Sun than Earth, or 97 astronomical units away. For comparison, Pluto is 40 astronomical units from the Sun. This places the new planet more or less in the Kuiper Belt, a dark realm beyond Neptune where thousands of small icy bodies orbit the Sun. The planet appears to be typical of Kuiper Belt objects, only much bigger. Its sheer size in relation to the 9 known planets means that it can only be classified as a planet itself, Brown says. Backyard astronomers with large telescopes can see the new planets, but don't expect to be impressed. It looks like a dim speck of light, visual magnitude 19. Moving very slowly against the starry background. It is currently almost directly overhead in the early morning eastern sky in the constellation Cetus, notes Brown. The planet was discovered by, in addition to Brown, Chad Trujillo of the Gemini Observatory in Mauna Kea, Hawaii, and David Rabinowitz of Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, on January 8, 2005. They first photographed the new planet with a 48-inch Samuel Ossian telescope on October 31, 2003. The object was so far away, however, that its motion was not detected until they reanalyzed the data in January of this year. In the past 7 months, the scientists have been studying the planet to better estimate its size and its motions. We are 100% confident that this is the first object bigger than Pluto ever found in the outer solar system, Brown adds. Telescopes have not yet revealed the planet's disk. To estimate how big it is, the astronomers must rely on measurements of the planet's brightness. Like all planets, this new one presumably shines by reflecting sunlight. The bigger the planet, generally speaking, the bigger the reflection. The reflectance, the fraction of light that bounces off of them, is not yet known. Nevertheless, it is possible to set limits on the planet's diameter. Even if it reflected 100% of the light reaching it, it would still be as big as Pluto, says Brown. Pluto is 1,400 miles or 2,300 kilometers wide. I'd say it's probably about 1.5 times the size of Pluto, but we're not sure, says Brown. The size of the planet is further limited by NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope, which has already proved its mettle in studying the heat of dim, faint, faraway objects, such as the Kuiper Belt bodies. Because Spitzer has been unable to detect the new planet, the overall diameter must be less than about 2,000 miles, or 3,200 kilometers, says Brown. The planet's temporary name is 2003 UB-313. A permanent name has been proposed by the discoverers to the International Astronomical Union, and they are awaiting the decision of this body before announcing the name. Stay tuned. This story is based on a NASA press release. It's read by Tony Phillips and presented by Science at NASA.
Okay, everybody, that was not the moon video. It turns out what I wanted to show you ended up being all music. Some really great footage, but all music. What you just heard was a description of Nibiru. It's back. History is repeating itself. They can run, but they can't hide because Mother is here. I want to finish up with a few minutes of Richard Hoagland, and then we'll call it a night. Thanks, everybody. Let me load it up. Having a little trouble. Here it comes. Let's see.
Bob Jacobs, where were you? What were you filming and where were you?
I was officer in charge of optical instrumentation at Vandenberg Air Force Base from 1963 to 66.
That's
our job
California.
Was to photograph. That's California, so right there on the coast.
Right.
And our job was to photograph with high-speed instrumentation every missile launch from Vandenberg going down the test range. They wanted to find out if we could figure out a place to put a telescope where we could get a side view of the missile so that we could see all three stages of powered flight. So I went up to Big Sur, California, up on a U.S. Forest Service road on Anderson Peak, and I installed a telescopic sight up there. And the Air Force flew in a huge catodoptic optic telescope from the Cape. It was built by Dr. Walter Manning at the Boston University. They put the telescope up there. And with that thing, which had a focal length of 2,500 inches, we photographed an Atlas missile raising up out of the fog cover and flying downrange. We got all three stages of powered flight. And as the dummy warhead and the package flew on downrange, we were all celebrating the fact that we had seen a thing and accomplished the mission. When I got back to the base with the film the next day, I was called into the office of Major Florence J. Mansman. And there were three people in gray suits standing in there. There was a 16-millimeter camera and a screen set up. Major Mansman said, "Lieutenant, sit down and watch this." And he turned down the lights, turned on the camera, on the projector, and the film came on. And I recognized it as the film that we'd shot at Big Sur the previous day. Toward the end of the flight, I was looking at Major Mansman saying, "Pretty good stuff, huh, sir?" And suddenly he said, "Just watch this." And as I watched, the warhead, the dummy warhead, the chaff that was put out in front of it as a decoy to deflect the Russian anti-missile tracking radar. Everything was flying along, and suddenly, in the same direction this stuff was flying at about 8,000 miles an hour, an object came into the frame, shot a beam of light at the warhead, flew up to the top, shot another beam of light at the warhead, flew around the direction it was flying, shot another beam of light at the warhead, flew down, shot another beam of light at the warhead, and flew out the same way it came in.
Well, I don't understand. Why didn't you see this when you were shooting it?
Well, it was 600 to 800 miles away from us.